Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of Lyle Dick's CHA presidential address, titled On Local History and Local Historical Knowledge. Dick delivered his address on June 4th, 2013 at the Canadian Historical Association annual meeting in Victoria, BC. You can find recordings of other talks like this one at ActiveHistory.ca.
Chers collègues, dear historians, guests, and friends, it is an honor for me this afternoon to introduce our president, Lyle Dick, public historian, longtime employee of Parks Canada, administrator extraordinaire, advocate of our profession, and dear colleague. Au cours de ses études en histoire aux universités de Brandon et du Manitoba au milieu des années 70, Lyle s'est intéressé principalement aux déportations du Canada dans l'entre-deux-guerres. Suivirent trois décennies de travail à Parc Canada, d'où il a pris sa retraite il y a quelques mois. Initially based close to home in Winnipeg, he first helped commemorate prairie life with colleagues of all disciplines. We owe to his team the interpretive work around and about the Motherwell Homestead National Historic Park in Saskatchewan, a working farm, and also the preparatory research for the Grassland National Park. The book that came out of this research in 1989, Farmers Making Good, The Development of Abernethy District in Saskatchewan between 1880 and 1920, offered a comprehensive and interdisciplinary view of a small community in the best tradition of annals scholarship, from the quantitative analysis of homesteading costs to the politics of unrest, chapters in between on the nature of farmers' work, their beliefs, the structure of their socioeconomic lives, and their social relations. This work of outstanding and still this work is outstanding and still popular, as the Clio Prize for Prairie History attested at the time, and the second publication of recent year still attests. There began a fruitful pattern of work, research, and publishing, where he combined the work of Parks Canada with long hours of research and reflection outside of Parks Canada. There again, he worked in collaboration, this time with his lifelong partner, Ron Frowerk, with whom he traveled from one field of investigation to the other, and whose training and experience in archives and art history is present at every chapter. Le bureau de Parc Canada à Winnipeg couvre un vaste territoire, incluant la Saskatchewan, le Manitoba, le Yukon et les territoires du Nord-Ouest. Et Lyle commença un large projet sur les parcs du Nord, basé sur l'histoire orale de plusieurs communautés du Québec et de Nunavut. On peut lire les résultats de la recherche qui s'en suivit dans deux livres, dont Muskoq Land, Ellesmere Island in the Age of Contact, récipiendaire du prix Adam Innes, publié après deux décennies du genre de patiente enquête et de reconceptualisation qui fait l'objet de son discours de cet après-midi. For his later 15 years of public history, Lyle shifted his home and his attention to the West Coast, this time writing on human-ocean relations, polar exploration, and the commemoration of Canadian-European battlefields. His study of the unbelievable fate of Japanese-Canadian veteran surgeon Masumi Mitsui is one of his work that I know best, an attentive and imaginative reflection on a great many and painful paradoxes. He has also investigated trials of gay men in Winnipeg and Regina, returning in some ways to the history of persecutions he had written for his graduate work. He has now opened these questions to the larger social history of same-sex men in the prairies. Lyle's work in public history was accompanied by a steady outcome of reflexive articles and chapters on the nature of commemoration and interpretation in Canada, in articles on television, films, landscapes, animals, and more. In the early 1990s, the quality of his indefatigable work as a manager of public history projects hold him to preside over 3 years of rethinking the whole system plan review of the National Historic Sites Directorate. The consultation is teams devised from Ottawa, where he lived for 3 years in the early 90s, is a model of openness, ambition, and accountability, whose results help revamp and diversify national commemoration in remarkable directions. In the recent controversies over Library and Archives Canada, the Canadian Museum of History, and the announced Federal Review of History Teaching, his knowledge and his quiet insurance in matters of public consultations have served the Canadian Historical Society in important ways. The authors of a recent collection on Parks Canada Centenary have rightly turned to him to write their concluding chapter, and the editors of an upcoming textbook on public history have asked him to write the section on working in historic sites. Lyle est entré au Conseil de la Société historique du Canada comme le responsable du dossier des affaires publiques, une fonction pour laquelle il a participé au premier forum des usagers des archives. Il a épaulé les présidents qui l'ont précédé, Craig Herron et Marilyn Stewart, au cours d'années difficiles de coupures et de réorganisations au sein des grandes institutions fédérales. Lié à l'histoire, des archives au parc en passant par le musée de la guerre, il est donc arrivé à la présidence bien outillé pour faire face au dédoublement du travail de représentation publique. Sa persistance et sa connaissance semblent avoir porté fruit. Un peu plus, la Société historique du Canada est respectée, davantage connue et, espérons-le, un peu plus crainte qu'auparavant. It is this accumulated experience as a historian of local communities, which he has distillated for us this afternoon, in an address entitled On Local History and Local Historical Knowledge. I had the pleasure to read this text in advance, and to most of us, his knowledge of methods and theories and his deep understanding of the few Canadian places who were lucky to have him as their historian now make Lyle one of the elders of the profession. Elder with a small e, he would tell you. I say this seriously because of all the respect he has come to attach to the word elder, himself, those women and men on whose accumulated wisdom groups of people like us relies since time immemorial. Please join me to welcome our colleague and president, Lyle Dick.
Merci, Dominique. I'm humbled and delighted by your kind introduction, and it's very much appreciated. But as to the elder part, I keep saying it's just a number. The problem is they tell me it's a big number. But anyway, good to see everybody. Thanks, everybody, for coming today. My text is entirely in English. I apologize for that, but I thought it would be best in this instance to deliver it in the language in which it was written. When we get into the AGM, hopefully we'll have more appropriately full bilingual content. This address is dedicated to the memory of Professor Ed Ray, 67th President of the Canadian Historical Association, teacher, scholar, friend. I also want to acknowledge the assistance of Ron Froerich, Jean Barman, Valerie Koronick, Penny Bryden, and Ruth Sandwell, who kindly provided comments on the earlier drafts of this presentation. In keeping with the CHA conference theme of boundaries and edges, I will try to address two aspects of the study of the past that have preoccupied me for 35 years, local history and local historical knowledge, the latter an epistemological concept bearing upon who holds knowledge of the past and which forms of knowledge have value. This presentation distinguishes between microhistory as carried out by professionals and local history as practiced by both vernacular authors and professionals. I will attempt to define local history, outline some methods I've found useful, and suggest where it might enhance the general practice of history while making it a distinctive contribution in its own right. Over time, greater collaboration between professional historians and Canada's local communities might offer the potential to help us transcend the boundaries that sometimes still persist between the national and the local, the professional and the vernacular. While embraced to a greater degree than a generation ago, local history still occupies a subordinate place in scholarly historical production in Canada and elsewhere. And I know some would argue the opposite, but that's what I'm arguing. Several outstanding monographs have been prepared, but local studies are often passed over in survey textbooks and articles in Canadian historiography. Community studies and other so-termed particularist histories gained some brief notoriety during the so-called history wars of the 1990s, when their authors were chided for undermining the nation-state. However, our task is not to shore up patriotism, but rather to discover and illuminate the past as accurately and fully as possible in its manifold diversity. If smaller scale studies are sometimes better suited to addressing certain historical problems, we should not be reluctant to take that route. This is often the case with aspects of history that have been overlooked, for which we lack the basic data or community comparisons to enable sound generalizations. Much of the current professional production in local history is subsumed under the rubric of microhistory, which the Italian historians Carlo Ginzburg and Carlo Ponti have justified for two reasons: its role in reconstituting so-called real life and in investigating the invisible structures within which that lived experience is articulated. The investigation of invisible social and economic structures connecting the local to the general has been a particular strength of several microhistories of communities carried out across the country. In her monograph on Salt Spring Island, British Columbia, Ruth Sandwell examined household structures in identifying important departures from the assumed commercial orientation of the agricultural economy. The importance of family structure to farm economies was also central in Royden Lowen's studies of Manitoba's Mennonite communities, which emphasized adaptive strategies by immigrant farmers seeking to retain social and cultural difference. Gerard Bouchard's classic treatment of Quebec's Saguenay district included a comparative analysis of local family economies that placed its agricultural settlement into a continental context. And more recently, Beatrice Craig's Backwoods Consumers and Homespun Capitalists traced the development of local market cultures in a formative era of Atlantic Canada, illuminating the relationship between hinterlands and regional and global economies. These are just a few of the many excellent microhistories by professional historians that have increased our understanding of Canadian history on various levels. Each meets the criterion of Marc Bloch, co-founder of the French Annales School, that scholarly local history should illuminate wider social and economic phenomena. Achieving the other goal of microhistory identified by Ginzburg and Ponti, the reconstitution of so-called real life, is a different but no less challenging proposition, especially when reconstructing the history of places for which the evidence substantially resides within living historical memory. Here, oral history will come into play if we desire an accurate or comprehensive representation of past human experience, especially the repeatable everyday routines and activities at the heart of social history. For these kinds of projects, I prefer the term local history to microhistory, as the local extends beyond academic archival research to direct engagement and dialogue with local residents in their communities. There are numerous definitions of local history available, but for this discussion, I offer the following. Local history is the study of individuals and groups interacting within a specific locality in the past, often with continuing and tangible connections to the present. The scale of what I term local varies considerably according to the context. It might encompass a village or rural community, an urban neighborhood, or a cultural zone of human environmental interaction. Whatever the community, the tracing of detailed intersections between people within a particular social and cultural environment is what gives local history its potential vitality and explanatory power. Practicing local history also enables and often obliges us to draw upon elders. And as Dominique mentioned, I do distinguish between elders in First Nations and Aboriginal communities for which we tend to associate the term. But in those cases, I propose to capitalize the term elder. I think, though, that elder also does apply, not just to me, but I'm not sure that I'm worthy of that designation, but nevertheless, it does apply to many other communities, including our own community of scholarly history. And I've drawn on the valuable insight, mentorship, and wisdom of many elders in scholarly history, quite a few of whom are in the room today. My own approach to local history has changed over time through experience with the genre and interactions with people and communities. It seldom starts with the big picture and instead begins with research on a specific person, place, or artifact. While I have long been interested in theory, I try to avoid applying historical models, at least not before the late stages of a project, and then only with great caution. After defining a study spatially and temporally, and carrying out a review of the secondary literature, I shelve the historiography and try to forget about it, pending the development of more extensive data collection and the development of provisional hypotheses as a guide to further data collection. This process is repeated again and again until heuristic possibilities emerge, are tested, rejected, or revised, eventually congealing into provisional explanations. It only ends when all conclusions closely fit the evidence and other possible interpretations have been found wanting. Often enough, this approach has permitted me not only to generate different answers, but also, in some cases, to change the basic questions of these studies. And if evidence-centered so-called thick description and analysis of the local level indicates that we should move in a different direction than current historiography or our own presuppositions, then as professional historians, I think we need to be prepared to do that. If feasible, I think it's also important to try to experience directly the physical environments of the places and historical actors we're writing about. Indeed, if we're involved with local history. I would endorse the advice offered by David Hackett Fisher in his 2011 CHA keynote address in Fredericton that we should try wherever possible to, quote, go there, do it, and write about it, unquote. The most succinct, the best scholars have the most succinct way of expressing things, and that was a good one. Direct experience of historical places better equips us to grasp both the spatial and temporal dimensions of a locality in establishing what has changed and what has more or less stayed the same. In approaching local history, I have long been guided by an approach pioneered by Mark Bloch, which he termed understanding the past by the present. And that's in his book on historiography. Bloch rejected the notion that historical change, even in the modern world, has been so sweeping that most historical structures and cultural traditions disappeared after one or two generations. Rather, forces of inertia have ensured the persistence of many anterior forms into the present. Rather than commence historical inquiries at a fixed point in the past and reconstructing history forward in time, Bloch proposed beginning with the most vibrant and tangible evidence of earlier eras persisting in the here and now and tracing it backwards in time. His innovative approach had parallels in such other areas as geography, ethnography, and vernacular architecture studies, whose practitioners made similar use of extant evidence or of antecedent cultures surviving into the present to better understand the past. While it didn't start out that way, I found myself relying upon Bloch's prudently retrogressive approach while researching my book, Muskox Land. It was my second large-scale history project, initially intended to provide a context for interpreting the post-contact human history of Ellesmere Island National Park Reserve, now Kootenaibaw National Park of Canada, our most northerly national park in the north of Ellesmere Island. The 1988 agreement to establish the park reserve established a basis for cooperation between Parks Canada and Grease Fjord, Canada's most northerly community, an Inuit community on the south coast of Ellesmere Island. We planned an extensive oral history with residents and also former members of the community who had returned to Quebec to include their experience in this larger history. In November 1989, I traveled to Grise Fjord to explain the project, seek the community's input and approval, find local residents to carry it out. And I was then working with the notional theme of adaptation and developed an initial list of questions to address such issues as accommodations to modern technology in the first four decades following the community's establishment. In the actual interviews, however, these questions proved tangential to the concerns of the elders, especially those originating from northern Quebec who returned to their native community of Inukjuak in 1988. These individuals preferred to talk about the hardships of the relocation. Those individuals from Baffin Island who were still living in Grise Fjord discussed other topics, including the scarcity of game animals, the cost of gasoline, and the difficulty of hunting in such a challenging environment. It wasn't what I expected and didn't seem to fit in with the kind of narrative that seemed to be emerging from the archival research for this study. For a long time, I was uncertain how to proceed and decided to shelve the project for a few years until a way forward could be found. Coming back to the material several years later, I started again almost from scratch, this time beginning with the oral histories we had assembled and putting together the oral history data. Dealing with the recent history of the community helped me see the history of Grise Fjord and earlier high Arctic eras with fresh eyes. And it also prompted revisiting the textual evidence and the larger studies themes. It helped me see that even in the modern era, Inuit survival in the high Arctic owed more to the continuity of traditional knowledge and adaptive strategies developed over numerous generations than to externally driven cultural change, such as the introduction of Western talk technology, i.e. the snowmobile and other examples. Akin to Block's retrogressive method, I belatedly understood how Grise Fjord's recent experience incorporated important elements of earlier high Arctic history, or in Braudelian terms, how the long durée was embedded within the moyenne durée of recent history. The local data showed the importance of adaptation and adaptability to human survival in challenging contexts, a universal theme built up from the specific to the general and from the present into the past. In May 2001, I traveled back to Resolute Bay in Grise Fjord to participate in community consultations and presentations on the draft book to seek the input and advice of the communities. These presentations outlined the theme of 200 years of adaptation and survival in the high Arctic, including the more recent history since the relocations of the 50s. At the Resolute Bay meeting, Liza Ningyuk, who carried out several interviews for the oral history and was by then mayor of Grise Fjord, stood and said to me in Inuktitut, "I believe every word you said is true." Among the people attending my presentation at Grise Fjord a few days later was Liza's father, the late Abraham Piamini, a seasoned hunter and respected elder, who asserted his view that the Inuit were able to survive in the high Arctic because of caching. He was referring to their need to hunt as many animals as possible when encountering game on the trail and to cache the meat on the spot. The reason caching was so important was that the biomass in the high Arctic environment is very limited relative to more southerly biozones. And animals tend to be few and far between. Operating far from their communities, Inuit hunters could not immediately transport all the meat back from the kill sites, but caching enabled them to continue hunting, maximizing their efforts to ensure the community's survival. I had included a section of the manuscript on caching, but Piamini's comment warranted a fuller treatment, and the text was duly revised. Later, an archaeological colleague advised me that the eminent anthropologist Lewis Binford arrived at much the same conclusion as Piamini in a book on archaeological theory, based in part on his work with the Nunamiut of the Western Arctic. I find it fascinating that Binford and Piamini came to similar conclusions regarding critical adaptations enabling Arctic survival. But where Binford's conclusions derived from ethnographic study and abstract reasoning, Piamini's insight came from his life experience. It reminds us that there is more than one pathway to knowledge, and our understanding is only strengthened when different knowledge systems corroborate one another. This brings me to the second of my concerns today, local historical knowledge. And I will not be discussing traditional or local ecological knowledge, which have become common in bureaucratic circles. I would prefer to look at what vernacular historians have said about local historical knowledge. And typically, they define it as the outgrowth of common or shared experience. When revising Donald Gunn's History of the Red River Settlement in 1912, his grandson, George, placed the elder Gunn's historical knowledge into the experiential context of his career in the fur trade and social and intellectual interactions with other elders in that community. In Stories of My People, a collection of historical vignettes on Vancouver's Japanese-Canadian community over its first century, the vernacular historian Roy Ito similarly wrote that history should, quote, be told from the inside. A history is seen and remembered by the people who shared the experience, unquote. For both Gunn and Ito, local historical knowledge is not generated solipsistically by individuals, but flows instead from the common intersubjective experience of members of a community. Provisionally, I would define local historical knowledge as the shared understanding of the past produced by members of a locality in dialogical interaction in time and space. While abstract reasoning forms part of local knowledge, it is usually not oriented towards the abstract. It is knowledge put into action and applied in day-to-day living and problem-solving. Its value for historiography can be greatly enhanced when outsiders with professional training and skills, that is, professional historians, team up with local practitioners in collaborations drawing on complementary but different strengths. Throughout my career, I have looked for ways to better connect history, a written abstraction, to the realities of past life. For me, an outstanding model has long been Fernand Braudel's The Mediterranean and the Mediterranean World in the Age of Philip II, the first major work to advance and extensively engage the diversity of historical time. It is the quintessential example, of course, of macro history, taking the Mediterranean region of the 16th century as the world center, driving the global margins. Notwithstanding the many merits of this great work, I long felt we also needed an alternative model that might achieve the opposite, a history that, radiating out from the margins to the center and moving from the specific to the general, could inform macro history while respecting local difference. And recently, I found such a model after long looking for one, and that was unexpectedly found in the work of the American folklorist and material historian Henry Glassie. I first encountered Glassie's work when researching my first local history that became the book Farmers Making Good. His folk housing in Middle Virginia was then a vanguard study in the exciting field of vernacular architecture studies, illuminating American social and cultural history. At the time, I paid little attention to another of Glassie's books, a monumental local history of a small rural community in Northern Ireland called Passing the Time in Ballymanoni, published in 1982. Returning to it last year, I belatedly realized that this book and its companion volume, The Stars of Ballymanoni, published a quarter century later in 2006, are the breakthrough texts I'd long been seeking. Well, it may not have received the attention of Braudel's Mediterranean. Glassie's Ballymanoni is its equal, a completely different yet comprehensive and utterly compelling approach to reconstructing human history from the ground up, with local knowledge at its center. Passing the Time was the culmination of 10 years' collaboration between its author and the elders of Ballymanoni, a community riven by poverty and social conflict, yet amazingly rich in local culture and knowledge. Like much of Glassie's work, it is difficult to categorize. Part history, part ethnography, part folklore. It is steeped in the storytelling practices of a traditional community, nevertheless seeking to navigate its way through changing times and the often turbulent history of the island in which it is situated. If there is a hero in Glassie's book, it is the group of men and women comprising the community's elders. They are, or were, the stars of Ballymanoni, individuals whose talents functioned as the glue holding the community together. These storytellers and musicians kept alive the spirits of their fellow citizens during the dark period of the 1970s and early 1980s. when exploding bombs were part of the social landscape. Their keen powers of observation enabled them to find meaning in the unremarkable practices of daily life, the manifold ways that Ballymenone's residents passed the time through work at day and stories at night. If there is a hero of his particular text or his a particular favorite, it is Hugh Nolan, the community's philosopher, historian, and sage. He quotes several of Nolan's stories in their entirety, revealing his remarkable grasp of historical process and stature as an entertainer, educator, and poet. Nolan also has a gift for historical aphorism. Asked to comment on historical change, he comments cryptically, quote, "Things get better and they get worse." Only when you reflect on that innocuous statement do you realize how much knowledge is behind it. Rejecting the notion of patterns in history, Nolan observes simultaneous but different trajectories, that things are getting better and worse at the same time. The notion of concurrent progress and declension is at odds with monocausal models, but it seems a sophisticated approximation of the actual complexity of historical events. Braudel discovered asynchronous timescales through the study of world civilizations at the macro-historical level. Hugh Nolan came to a parallel perspective by closely observing local events and storytelling the history of his own community. Glassy's books are exemplars of dialogical writing. Rather than impose his words, he shares the stage with the elders and invites readers to join the conversation. In the manner of Dostoevsky, as interpreted by Mikhail Bakhtin, each of his characters is accorded their own voice, unfiltered and unsubordinated by the authors. As further elaborated in Bakhtin's Art and Answerability, the author's voice is always shaped in relation to other voices to whom the author and indeed their readers are answerable. Glassy's focus on polyphony and dialogue represents a deeply ethical commitment to the people of this community with whom he has generated a work of genuine collaboration, a history of, for, and by the people. Of course, Glassy's Ballymenone is a quasi-traditional society where, notwithstanding the intrusion of the modern age, its history has changed relatively slowly, at least up until the last few decades. The world of Ballymenone seems remote from present-day Canada, where few of us live in the communities where we were raised. Our current places of residence, whether urban or rural, are characterized by ever-accelerating social and economic change and high rates of mobility, continually uprooting us and weakening long-established connections in time and place. And yet, we are not done with local history and local historical knowledge, and they are not done with us. There are still communities of long-standing duration in this country, both rural and urban, where local historical knowledge persists. Many of residents, sages who, with little outside assistance, continue to patiently document their histories and tell their stories. These elders include such people as Joe Wei, a Vancouver architect with a vast knowledge of Chinese-Canadian history and heritage, and the leading advocate of Vancouver's Chinatown for more than 40 years, which he was instrumental in nominating as a National Historic Site. That's Vancouver's Chinatown. Another was Grace Iko Thompson, the former president of the National Association of Japanese Canadians. Grace initiated nominations to commemorate Tomokichi Homma, an early advocate for disfranchised Japanese Canadians, and the Asahi baseball team, the remarkably successful Japanese-Canadian ball team based at Oppenheimer Park in Japantown in Vancouver. Both have now been commemorated. In increasingly urban environments, other Canadians are establishing new connections over time that may evolve into enduring local communities. A case in point is Canada's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered community, often obliged to move away from the negativity of traditional environments. LGBT people have reestablished networks of several decades' duration in cities across Canada. And this is, of course, Davie Village, the heart of Vancouver's lesbian and gay community. My partner and I live two blocks away. The work of Valerie Kornick with LGBT elders and communities on the prairies is a fine example of how the study of detailed interactions at the local level is helping us better understand Canada's recent history, notwithstanding our contemporary condition of uprootedness and diaspora. A similar process is evident among Canada's Aboriginal peoples, ethnocultural communities, and other minorities, many of whose members have also moved and been obliged to adapt to new environments. We cannot predict the future, but as these newer communities evolve over time, they may well benefit from local historical knowledge produced every day by individuals in dialogue with others, both near and far. A sobering caveat is that the continued erosion of governmental support for local archives, including the recent cancellation of the National Archival Development Program, poses major challenges to the protection and stewardship of irreplaceable documents and the future practice of local history in Canada. Each of us concerned with protecting the legacy and possibility of local history has a responsibility to challenge unwise public policy decisions imperiling this heritage while voicing our support for programs that will continue to foster the continued viability of local historical research in the future. And I want to thank Penny Bryden for suggesting including that point. I want to conclude with an anecdote and an image. In 1992, I had the good fortune to meet the late William Commanda, the senior elder of the Algonquin people at Maniwaki, Quebec. The National Capital Region is within the Algonquin people's traditional territory. At that time, I was coordinating Parks Canada's strategic plan for new commemorations, and we wanted him to formally preside at our first national workshop on the history of Aboriginal peoples. A colleague and I drove to Maniwaki to meet with William, then in his late 70s. He politely received us, but put off any discussion of our request until late in the day. In the meantime, he had some environmental and historical lessons to impart to us. He took us into the woods to inspect the birch trees, then withering from acid rain contamination. For Commanda, who had made 200 birch bark canoes, many housed in royal and museum collections, this was a calamity. Returning to his house, he showed us the wampum belts, the ancient artifacts on which the history of his people is written in colored beads. After several hours instructing us in spiritual, environmental, and historical matters, he accepted our invitation to preside at our workshop. At the workshop in the boardroom of the Canadian Museum of Civilization a few months later, Chief Commanda prayed to the Creator, burned sweet grass, and brought it around the table to envelop each participant with a smoke, a cleansing ritual that also underscored the importance of harmony in our discussions. Later, he took a lively role in the exchange, sharing his expansive knowledge and speaking on both environmental and historical issues. He referred to the Royal Proclamation of 1763 as written on the sacred wampum belts and its implications for the rights of Aboriginal peoples. He also discussed the graves of members of his people on Victoria Island in the middle of the Ottawa River and his First Nations efforts to set the island aside as an Aboriginal heritage site. For us, it was a rare privilege to see this wise old man in action, but perhaps it was just another day in the life of a great elder. He passed away 2 years ago at the age of 97, 3 years after being awarded the Order of Canada. Observing the Idle No More protests that took place on Victoria Island earlier this year, following the movement's beginnings in Saskatoon, I was reminded of those meetings 20 years ago with Chief Commanda, his close connections to his community, and the importance he attached to place in the history of his First Nation. For me, this image of a wigwam on Victoria Island, with Canada's Parliament buildings in the background, perfectly expresses the kind of perspective I think he might have wanted us to have on our country's history. It's a perspective that is aware of the nation state, but ever mindful of the unique vantage points on history endowed by local historical perspective, appreciating what we have in common, but never forgetting who we are or where we came from. Local historical knowledge is all around us. It is inscribed in our memories of people, places, and shared experiences. It is integral to our identity as members of communities with a common history. It strengthens connections between people, past and present, and it better positions us to face the future. As long as we live in communities, local historical knowledge will continue to be generated as we interact with one another and adapt to our environments. As historians, we have barely scratched the surface of the possibilities for documenting and interpreting local historical experience. The field is wide open for study and experimentation. Long live local history and local historical knowledge. Thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of Lyle Dick's CHA presidential address titled On Local History and Local Historical Knowledge. Dick delivered his address on June 4th, 2013 at the Canadian Historical Association annual meeting in Victoria, BC. You can find recordings of other talks like this one at activehistory.ca.